So I'll go ahead and get started. I broke the lecture into three parts, and the first part is about neural recordings. Anyone know what this is? Yeah, the brain, okay. And so the brain is made up of billions of neurons, right? So how many? Does anyone know how many neurons are in the brain? 100 billion. Yeah, they used to say 100 billion. It's about, yeah, it's in the billions, you're right. So it's about 80 billion neurons in the brain. And then the only way you could really study them right now is to you go get your PhD. And so 2009, this was my co-founder and I getting our PhDs at the University of Michigan here in town. And we had to get this expensive equipment to sort of record the brains of these activities. But if you looked at my lab today, it would look like this. These are kind of open source hardware tools that we use to do very similar experiments that we were doing in the lab, but now we're going to do it in our own backyards. And so 20% of the world has a neurological disorder, and that comes from the World Health Organization. And there are no known cures for these diseases. There's no pill you can take to get over Alzheimer's or any other diseases that are out there. And so what we should be doing is sort of teaching students early on about neuroscience and about how the brain works, get them interested into the field, but we don't. We don't teach it at all, which is a bit of a shame, actually. And so if I make the analogy to astronomy, it'd be like if you wanted to learn a little bit about the stars, you had to go out and get a PhD in astrophysics just to get access to the tools to understand a little bit about how the heavens work. But that's not true, and you can just go buy a cheap telescope at Walmart, and you can go set up in your backyard, and for like $40, you can see a little bit about how the heavens move, and maybe you're interested in becoming an astronomer or just in science in general. It's good for the economy in general, for people sort of being interested in science and sort of thinking a little bit more skeptically about things. But there's no tools like this, like a cheap telescope, at least when I started in grad school, to sort of study the brain. So that's where we came in. And so we were looking at ways that we could engage students early in neuroscience. And so we would go out to schools and we would put, you know, prison goggles on to change their vision and let sort of like the cerebellum correct for it. You take the prison goggles off and you see when they throw a ball, they're actually missing the target on one side versus another side when they had the prison goggles on. You can show kids which areas of the brain do things. We had a paper mache Frankenstein with an ice cream brain, and we would scoop out part of the brain and we'd create a lesion. That's how you do it in neuroscience. And we would transfer that lesion to one of the students, and you would see if you took out the motor cortex of this paper mache guy, you'd lose the ability to move your arms. You know, if you took out your amygdala, you no longer had fear, which is kind of cool. But that wasn't really getting at what we were doing in the lab. What we were doing in the lab was really cool. We were actually studying the brain, understanding a little bit about how cells in the brain allow us to do the behaviors that allow us to do the things that we do in the world, right? And so you're kind of looking at it, stepping backwards and backwards into the brain to get at the core principles of what makes us who we are. And this is not really getting at that, and that was really bothersome. And so what we did, so this is Tim Marzullo. When I say we, it's Tim Marzullo. He was my lab mate, also from the Midwest. He grew up in Toledo, but went to University of Michigan for graduate school. We started a project called the $100 Spike. This is the poster that we submitted at the Society for Neuroscience. It was a real poster with a real $20 bill. We didn't have a $100 bill. So we and actually, it was up for a week, and no one stole it. So I guess it tells you something about the kindness of neuroscientists. We showed people, you know, listen, we submitted this abstract in March, and the conference, this year's conference is in November. I think this was in late October. So we had the entire summer that we were going to do this self-imposed engineering challenge. And we told in the abstract, it was called the $100 Spike. We said, listen, we're going to try to build a kit that records the brains like we do in the lab with a $100 budget. And we're going to try to do that and show it to you by the time the Society for Neuroscience comes around this year. And so when Society for Neuroscience, there was a much younger me here and Tim over there. We were showing off our inventions here. We had a circuit board and some wing nuts and some balsa woods to hold a manipulator to hold a subject in place and put some wires in there. And it didn't even quite work. That's the amazing thing. But it got people interested enough that they kept asking us, hey, you know, and we got it working. Maybe it took about another month, maybe 2 months after this, and we finally got it up and running. And people kept asking us over and over again, hey, can I buy one of these? And I think because it said $100 in the titles, I think people were thinking, ah, this is like a store, you know? And so they kept bugging us about it, and we made it onto the Nature, the journal Nature's podcast, and so they interviewed us about the project, and then that kind of blew up, and we started getting more and more emails. And meanwhile, in the university, I'm doing all this cool research, publishing all these high-profile papers, and I get no emails, nothing. I get no response. No one knows what I'm doing. But this little side project that I started with Tim kept getting all these responses, and that slowly you realize that maybe the side project should be your main project, you know. And so then, while I was still in graduate school, I decided, all right, well, let's start this as a venture. And so we went through the University of Michigan, number of incubators, came up with the idea of building this kit. So this is a paper that we published that sort of went through the process of how we've done this. Where the other thing is, we try to be very academic about what we do, and we try to publish along the way to sort of show other people, other scientists, that it's possible to sort of make an alternative academic career outside of the university, which is, I can talk about that later, it's a growing importance. But this is the evolution of our invention, which I'm going to show you in a few minutes. And what it allows you to do is it allows you to record the brain, and we now sell these as kits for less than $50. So it's $49.99. You can build a kit yourself and record living brain cells inside the brain. So we're going to do that right now. We're going to be able to, instead of using racks of equipment like I had in grad school, we're going to use a little box, and we're going to use your cell phone instead of using an oscilloscope or an iPad or whatever, or a computer if you have it. We started off on computers, and our test audiences, the fifth graders, are like, psh, I want that on my phone. We're like, oh, okay, I never thought of that. That's a good idea. So we went back to the drawing board. So this is what we're going to be doing for our in the first bit of this talk right here. And so let's go back, because I'm not sure what everyone's background is. I just want to explain a bit. We talked about the number of cells in the brain, but let's kind of take a step back and understand a little bit about these cells, how they live, what they do. Does anyone know who this is? This is Cajal. So he was Ramon Cajal is the neuroscientist, or he was a scientist that first stained cells in Spain. So he was the, when he looked through his microscope, he saw these. It was a Golgi stain, and he was able to identify different parts of the brain, different regions of the brain, based upon the density of cells inside of the brain. So, but these things right here, all these cells are interconnected, right? So these are the kind of the base of the brain. So we start off with a unit of cellular, a cellular unit, I guess, and they build up into small networks, and these networks build up into larger networks, and through these larger networks, they start to come in through, loops and stuff like that. So your brain is always kind of running, and input comes into the brain through your sight, through your smell, through your ears. Sort of perturbs that network and creates what we call consciousness. But it's all consciousness, or if you really dig down into it, are these things right here. Okay, these are. I should come back to the slide because I want to show you some things, but I want to talk about them first. And so I was just showing, this was our, Cajal had a beautiful big microscope, but now we use our 3D printers, and some we can actually pour molds now to actually increase our productivity, and produce microscopes ourselves, and you can actually see these same types of Golgi stains inside your own garage or your basement. All right, so let's go back to these cells here. These are the special cells. Anyone know what these cells are called? Neurons, all right, good. Does anyone know what this thing is called right here? We call it a process. No, what'd you say? Synapse? No. Axon. Yeah, dendrite. So I heard three words. I heard someone said synapse, someone said axon, someone said dendrites. So let's go ahead and define these now. This right here is the dendrite. All right. This is the inputs of the cell. And what's this? Nucleus. And what's this? Yeah, I don't know. I think it's like the artist just drew something. That is the ribosome. I don't know what that is. All right, so, and what's this right here? This is the axon, right? That's what this one is. And the synapse, which someone mentioned over here, is this small piece right here. This is it's through that synapse in which learning and memory and behaviors, all those things get stored. It's all about the waiting probability of when this guy fires a signal to this guy, is how likely does that guy fire a signal to the next guy? It seems weird, but that's really what it all comes down to. All right? And we can actually, as neuroscientists, really start to tease apart this circuit and do really clever experiments to understand a little bit of how this brain works. And we're going to do that tonight. So I want to talk about that electricity that comes down. So at the very end, I'm going to go back. At the very end, there is a chemical jump between the two cells, but this is all electrical. Does anyone know why it's electrical? Any guesses on why it's not chemical? So, I mean, this goes back, this is kind of an interesting question. So it goes back to why do we have a brain? And then interesting. So like, and so you can ask even kids, you ask kids, like, does a tree have a brain? They'll say, no, a tree doesn't have a brain. Does a rat have a brain? Yeah, I think a rat has a brain. It's like, there's some difference between a rat and a tree, but what do you guys think it is? Reaction time. Yeah, so they're quick, they move, right? So the reason why we have electricity is we want to be able to react quickly, and so it's really, really fast. Electricity is fast, right? It's the speed of light. This isn't the speed of light. These are ionic currents, not like electrical currents, but they are much, much faster. And there are chemical processes in the body that take hormones, for example. You know, there's even neuron to hormone control. When you get hungry, that's your brain telling your body slowly that you're hungry, right? You slowly get hungry. But if you're about to be attacked by a lion, you don't want to slowly, you know, move, right? Because you want to like jump out of the way. And you can also tell, interestingly enough, about how important that circuit is for survival by how fast those neurons fire. And so you will see this in nature all the time, and even in the human. So like when you stub your toe, you know, you feel that reaction before you actually feel the pain, because it's not as important that you feel the pain, the more important that you pull your leg back. So like even in that simple example, you can see this sort of driving through. All right. So this is what the unit of activity of the electrical impulse looks like. There's little ion channels that open and close, and they're going to create what's called an act potential, or a spike. All right, this is what we lovingly refer to as spikes, and it looks like a railroad spike. And this is kind of like the basis, this is like the euro of the brain, the common currency, if you will, how all information gets passed from your eyes, from your ears. When you think about someone, when you remember what your grandmother's basement smelled like, all these things are stored in these synapses, and they create these act potentials. And so this is how everything is, all right? And so we're going to record. So this is the skin of the cell. Is like a little barrier, right? So it's going to push out an ion. So remember, where do we come from? The ocean, right? So we have salt water running through all of our veins and in our bodies. And so we have sodium, potassium, chloride. These are all charged particles that are floating inside of our bodies. And so what the neuron does in order to create an electrical pulse, it pushes all the sodium on one side and all the potassium on the other side, all right? So then when everything is cool, like it's equal, they're sort of balancing each other out, so it's positive, positive, so we got nothing on the inside. So if you put an electrode inside the cell, we wouldn't see a much of a change between these two. There's no electrical charge. But what would happen if we open up one of the sodium channels? This is sodium rushing in. Now we have more positive on the inside, right? And so then we see the voltage jump up over here. And then what happens? Now the potassium jumps back out again. All right, and so now the voltage is going to drop back down again. And then what's going to happen is that it reverses. So they're going to, this is where all the energy, so it's kind of cool, the artist, this is one of our artists also based here in Ann Arbor, Christina, drew this as an arm kind of with muscles kind of throwing these things back. It takes a lot of energy to push these things against their forces back into their side. And this is why, you know, I think it's, 40% of our energy is taken up by the brain. It's this process right here is what actually is doing it. So it's all that energy is taken just to push those ions on the other side so that you can fire an action potential. So that's a very, very, very expensive process inside the brain. So it must mean that this is really important, right? If we're spending all this energy on that, it must be important for us as humans to, or as animals, I guess, to do it. So then it returns back to its normal state. But that symbol right there, that little spike, is how all action potentials get propagated. We're going to take a look at that in real time in just a minute, okay? And we're not going to do that with my brain. I'm not going to pick someone's from the audience's brain and drill into it. I'm going to instead use our good friend here, La Cucaracha. These are cockroaches. They come from South America. We chose this picture because at Backyard Brains, the company that we founded back in when I was in grad school, we really like cockroaches, and we think they're completely misunderstood in society. And you see a lot of people interested in, you know, dragonflies and butterflies. You see them getting tattoos and shirts and flags. But you never see a flag with a cockroach on or a tattoo of like some cool cockroach doing something interesting, right? So we're trying here to restore the roar for the cockroach. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at the nervous system of the cockroach, and we're going to make some analogies to the human nervous system, because we believe that as neuroscientists and as evolutionary biologists, that the neuron only evolved once in the history of all of neuroscience. So, like, I think it was about a half a billion, 500 million years ago, the very first sort of merging together of cells at the beginning of the forend of the animal and the spinal cord tract happened in a worm about a half a billion years ago, 500 million years ago. And ever since then, all the animals that sort of branched off from that evolutionary tree have had the same neurons that are in there. Yeah, so this is the spinal cord of a human, and this is the spinal cord. It's not called that. There's no spines in these guys, but it's called the ventral nerve cord. But you can see a lot of similarities just by putting them side by side between these two. You've got a bunch of nuclei fused together up here, but this is our brain, right? So you can see the big difference. But if you were to slice it and do that stain that we looked at the beginning and look at a cockroach brain, then look at a human brain, it'd be hard for you to determine which one was which, because the neurons are really, really similar between these species. All right. So to get started, we're going to start with this experiment that was first done in 1928. This is Sir Lord Adrian. And he was the first person to notice these action potentials, these spikes. And he was doing it in, I believe it was in a frog, is when he had frog vision, is what he was noticing it in. But we're going to do that right now. And so I need a volunteer. Can I get a volunteer from the audience? All right, come on down. All right. So we have a picture up here. What is your name?
Heidi.
Heidi. Heidi is going to be our anesthesiologist. And so your job is I want you to knock out, I have here a jar of ice water,
mm-hmm.
All right, and I have a South American cockroach in here.
Okay.
You probably think they're not in there, but they actually are. They're hiding. So these guys like to live in the barks of trees.
Oh, they're huge.
Yeah, they're bigger than the ones you probably see here. So I need you to pick up one,
okay,
and stick it in. Wow, look at you, Heidi. All right, this is cool. That's always the toughest.
Can it wiggle?
It might. They are a lot. They're not dead, so.
Have to
All right. So you have to also verify that guy was alive when you put him in.
Very
right?
Much so.
All right. So then just kind of dunk him in a little bit. All right. So now we're going to wait a couple seconds. So let's think about what's happening here. So we put this guy into ice water. Heidi is our anesthesiologist. So what does an anesthesiologist do at a hospital or like? Does anyone know? You knock people out, right? But they knock people out, and they do what? They allow them to come back, right? So it's not like you're just killing them, right? So this guy's not going to be killed, even though if you want to take him out for a second, you're going to notice a behavioral change in him.
Slow.
Yeah. So now he's completely. It looks like he's completely different than he was just a second ago, right? And so I'll put him back and let him cook a little bit more. But so what's happening? What do you guys think is happening? Why is this cockroach no longer moving? It's numb, yeah, but why? We're trying to get down to the nitty-gritties of it.
Slowing down the electrical impulses.
Yes, but how is it slowing down the electrical impulses? This is absolutely right.
Well, they move slowly.
All right, let's go back.
Molecules
move slowly. Let's take a look back here. So remember these guys are opening and closing, right? And so what happens when things get colder? Slows down, right? So if you change the kinematics of this thing opening and closing, now we can't get sodium, potassium to change, right? And so therefore, all those spikes will disappear. And so if the spikes don't disappear, if they disappear, the cockroach can no longer move. It can no longer feel pain. So that's why we call you anesthesiologist. It's like, we're doing this because we're going to do a surgery on him in just a minute. But we don't want him to sort of feel pain. So we've kind of knocked him out. And so because he's cold-blooded, he can't regulate his body temperature. And so it becomes the same temperature as the outside world. Is going to chill these guys out, change the way they move. And that's why this whole thing works. Okay. Thank you. A round of applause for our first brave soul. I need one more volunteer. You don't have to touch a moving cockroach. Yeah. All right, come on down, mate. So you are going to be our neurosurgeon. All right. So what we're going to do is you're going to cut off one of the legs of this guy's, all right? So this is the legs, and we'll talk about this in a minute. But the reason why you're going to cut off the leg is I want to record from one of the neurons that are inside that leg. And so if you look up and down, if you take a look at these cockroaches' legs, you're going to see that it's got all these hairs kind of running up and down the legs. Mm. And so in those hairs lives a neuron. And that neuron's job is to sort of tell the brain when something's vibrating. So when it feels something like you opening up the door, opening up in your cupboard, they can sense that and they run away, right? And so one of the reasons why people don't like cockroaches is that they're one of the fastest animal to body length in the animal kingdom. So they're faster than a cougar and all these other things, right? Cheetahs, but they're just small. They don't seem that they don't go as fast, but they are extremely fast, and I think it creeps people out. Anyway, so I want you to cut off one of his legs in the back. And I will explain, yeah, so you can just take off one of his back legs, and I'll show you where to cut. Try to cut, like, close to the body wall.
The joint.
Yeah, to the joint right there. So if you grab right there, yeah, maybe halfway up there, like halfway through there. Yeah, perfect. Oh, yeah, you've done this before?
Apparently not.
All right. One false move. All right, thank you so much, man.
Absolutely.
What was your name?
Alex.
Yeah. All right, round of applause for Alex, our neurosurgeon. All right. So Alex has cut off a leg. And so right now these neurons are starting to warm back up again. I'm putting it in my hand. And so then the ion channels are starting to become a little bit more responsive. But this guy is still in the ice water, right? So he's still anesthetized. And we're going to let him sort of recover a bit. And we're going to put him back into our container and bring him back home to Shady Acres. He's going to recover 100%. I'm not sure if we have pictures here. Yeah, so here is these are different stages of the molting. And so when you cut off a leg, you can see right here the leg starts to come back after one molt. And that's about 40 days. Do I have the second one yet? Yeah, here it is. So there's the same cockroach. Now, I think it's like 72 days is what it turns out to be, that these legs do grow back. And so my co-founder is publishing a paper right now. It took him, it's got a running joke. It's almost 3 years to publish this data set. People want more data, but like we're busy people. We have day jobs. We have to keep collecting these data. Anyway, so, but they do come back. So it is nice to know. All right. So now I need another volunteer. All right, we don't have to do this. We don't have to do this. All right, come on down. All right, so you are going to be our electrophysiologist. An electrophysiologist, does anyone know what an electrophysiologist does? Of course not, yeah, that's what I did in grad school. I was an electrophysiologist. So the electrophysiologist is the person who puts the electrodes inside the brain to make sure that everything is okay. So for example, my dad's is in the hospital right now on the neuro floor. And although he doesn't have a seizure, a lot of people on the floor there do have seizures. And so if you had a seizure that didn't respond well to medicine, one of the treatments is that you go into a hospital, someone puts an electrical grid all across your brain, and they wait for you to have a seizure, and then they look at all the wires inside that were inside the brain, and then try to figure out where was the center of that seizure, and then come in and snip it out, all right? And so the person who puts the wires in there and sort of records that brain activity is the electrophysiologist, and so that's your job. So I'm going to give you this cockroach leg, and I want you to stick a couple pins through there.
Anywhere?
Yeah, you can stick it anywhere. You can see on there I've got a kind of representative drawing, but you can put one in the back here, and then maybe one in the femur there. Yeah, that's good. All right, and put another one in right there.
About there?
Yeah, that's good. Okay, perfect. And then before you go, we're going to try, I'm going to get a little speaker here. So everyone's going to, if this works, and science doesn't always work, do I have another one? No, so I'll use this one. We are going to, possibly for the first time in your life, hear what the brain sounds like, all right? So remember, this is a cockroach leg, but this is also very similar to what your brain's going to sound like. If I were to stick a wire, if I were to drill a small hole into your head, it's called a burr hole, and place a wire inside there, hook it up to the speaker, you would hear the exact same thing we're going to hear right now. All right, so without any further ado, go ahead and turn this on, and everyone kind of close your eyes, and we'll see if it works. All right, go for it. Ah. What does that sound like to you? Rain?
Static.
Is it not working? Is there
no
any
signal coming through?
There's no signal. Do you guys hear any patterns or anything that's... Is it... Yeah, it sounds like a little bit of a... So this, to me, as an electrophysiologist, you know, as us, I should say, is the most beautiful sound in the world. This is what your brain sounds like, all right? So we're actually listening to those little act potentials, those spikes, and they sound like a click. They almost sound like a popping sound, like a popcorn popping, or people say raindrops before. But it actually is encoding information, so we could actually do an experiment right now. So what did we say that we think those neurons are encoding? Does anyone remember?
Each of the clicks in the background is a...
Is a neuron, yeah. So we'll go through it a little bit more. But let's just test this hypothesis. I'm suggesting that these are neurons, and they're encoding information such as touch or vibrations. What experiment can we do right now to sort of test the hypothesis? Yeah, we can go touch it. So I'm going to get... We've partnered with a company in Seattle to make cockroach touchers. So you can take this. That's a joke. It's from Starbucks. So just go ahead and brush the hairs on the leg. Yeah, you guys hear that? So you can't even see when he's touching it, but you know when he's touching it, right? And so that is information being transferred. Do you have a question? Ah, that's a good question. All right, so there are a couple of interesting things come up. If I were to, for example, if I were to cut off your leg, how long would your neurons keep firing, do you think? Maybe not that long. So it would probably take about a minute, 2 minutes, and then they die. You can't live very long without oxygen, right? But the other cool thing about these invertebrates is that they breathe through their skin. And so this guy is still breathing. So this neuron will stay alive for... I think our record is about 2 days. So that's a pretty amazing time. So, yeah, so you can keep touching those neurons all day, and they'll keep firing. The next question is, why, if it's disconnected from the body, why would it keep firing, right? But if you go back to that picture of that neuron, which was here, so this neuron is one way, right? It's just sending information up to the brain. So that's the peripheral nervous system sending information into the central nervous system. So that little neuron has no idea that it's disconnected, and it's going to keep sending that signal. So every time that you touch that, it's going to keep sending that in there. All right, so we'll stay here. I don't want you to leave quite yet. You're not done. Electrophysiologists also look at the signals, right? So I told you they were observing them in another room. So we're going to set that up here. And we're going to use an iPad. It's a little bit bigger. And there's an app for that, exactly. All right. Oh, of course, it doesn't work. All right. Where's my phone? We'll do it this way. I think I need to be on the Wi-Fi for that one to work. Okay. So we'll do it the old-fashioned way. There we go. Okay, so now I'm going to hook this same guy up. So right now when I'm talking, you're seeing my voice on here, okay? But if I plug in the little microphone jack, so it's no longer hearing my voice. It's going to pick up whatever comes into here. And so if I plug this into the speaker box. So those are those action potentials that we were talking about before. So let's go ahead and do it again. Yeah, you see those. And that's information. This is how information gets passed from one neuron to the other. It's through electrical impulses. Right now, we're what's called extracellular recordings. We're sticking a pin through the leg of a cockroach. There's an axon that's running by that pin. The current gets picked up from the axon into the metal, which comes into our speaker box and gets amplified. And that's what we're listening to and what we're seeing on the screen. But every individual spike that you're seeing across there is actual neurons. So these are real neurons communicating. I could put a threshold on here. So if you have an engineer in the house, they'll know what a threshold is. But so every time it passes by the line, we're going to take a snapshot of it. I'm going to turn it this way right now. And if we take a look at what the average, move it up here, And now, what does that look like? It looks like that thing I showed you, right? That's the sodium, potassium, and then returning back to the baseline. So this is in real time. We're doing an experiment on a cell phone. Okay. Yeah, that's probably my thing. All right. So this is what we call in teaching a learning moment, right? So this is the brain isn't the only thing that uses electrical impulses. Cell phones and everything else does as well. All right. So thank you so much. A round of applause for our electrophysiologists.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. And so you guys have just seen a neuron and heard a neuron possibly for the first time. And this is something that our company is really proud of. And so we put on our website every time we showed. So I'm going to go back tonight. I'm going to count up how people were here. How people have seen it. That's the first time everyone seen a spike. Anyone heard one before? All right. So everyone, this is the new. These are new. Maybe you've seen one already. We don't just do these demonstrations. We also write hand guides for teachers in classrooms. Our goal is to sort of create a neural revolution. We create another new generation of neuroscientists that are interested and keen about doing experiments. And so we publish a series of papers that are for educators to read and to kind of like crucially go through our data and sort of pick it apart and sort of show that this is for real. So these are a couple of experiments. This is what we just saw earlier. So this is our really old, this was in 2012 we published this first paper. This is a figure from there. But you can see here, these are the spikes. These are the active potentials. You can see two different neurons sending two different signals. So the one thing that you should know is that a neuron always sends the exact same shape of the active potential every time. Every spike is the same. Same, because it's the same ion channels opening and closing. So when you see things like this, where you see a small spike and a big spike right next to it, those are two different neurons that are sending back two axons past that pin, and we just picked up two of them by chance, right? And so you can see there's at least two neurons there. Maybe there's more. Let's just zoom in on that. And then if you go back in, you can see, so here's one neuron right here, and every time you touch the barb, that thing increases its firing rate. So this is what's called rate coding. And so the way information, one of the ways that information gets passed in the brain is through rate coding, which means the neuron doesn't change the size of the signal. What is changing is what? The frequency. And so this is the number of times per second that the spike's coming here. So you can see, just by kind of squinting your eyes, you can see I touched the leg three times, right? But the brain knows that because it gets more electricity or more chemicals during this period than it does through this period. So this is how that information is getting passed, all right? And then to sort of prove to you or to the reviewers and others that this is real, so you can stick the entire spiker box into an ice box and still record it. And so when you do that, the neurons go away, which is what this one is. And then if you take it back out of the freezer and you're still recording it and you wait a while, the neurons start to fire again. So that tells you that, all right, whatever this is, if it's noise, it probably doesn't change that much with a bit of temperature between, like, you know, room temperature and a freezing temperature. But whatever this is, which makes you think that it is a biological system that's freezing. So anyway, so we've done science tonight. Everyone cool so far? Any questions so far? No. All right. You got a question? Yes. Oh, yeah. So it's actually not inside the brain. It's inside the brain, so to speak, but it's actually inside the neurons. And so we are sitting in this picture right here. We are sitting just outside the cell, and there's an axon that's coming by. And so it's inside the axon is where, so inside the axon there's potassium, and on the outside there's sodium. And so what we're seeing is the voltage when these ion channels open and close. And we can't see the ion channels, but what we can see is the voltage of when sodium rushes in, and then potassium rushes back out again and then comes back to baseline. So this is where you would see it if you could see it. And I always would love to do an experiment where you can actually zoom in and look at these ion channels. And you can do that. Some people, we're trying to figure out a way to do that at Backyard Brain. So everything we try to do is like it's in the like things you can do at home. And for those right now, we're talking about some ways that we can do that using oocytes, which are like frog eggs. But you can sort of make them so that they grow ion channels and actually see the individual ion channels opening and closing. I think that'd be kind of a fun experiment. Okay. But that's where you'd see it. Any other questions? Yeah?
Does the, in freezer, removed from freezer, it looks like the height varies.
Yeah, it does. It looks like
the timing of the uptake in the...
Yeah, so no, so it's the same timing in all the spikes, but why do some look different than others, right? So like, and the reason why, so this neuron just happens to come on a little bit sooner. I don't know why the timing of that one is different, but there's maybe like 5 or 6 neurons in here, and you see them coming back, but the idea is that they're all the same. So like here you see those maybe 2 different neurons here. But the reason why they might look different, they look like they have different type of properties, but they actually don't, is that where the pin is a little bit further away from this smaller one. So these guys are further away, and then the further away you are, the higher the probability that you're going to record from them, which is why the smaller ones kind of come on first, and then the ones that are closest to you take their sweet old time. It looks like there's one here, another one closer to you kind of comes online. But they all should have very similar properties as far as the firing rates and this type of stuff. So.
My question is around it. Does temperature affect the speed of transmission?
Oh, it does. And we actually have experiments on that you can do at home. So, yes, it does. So, yeah, so if you slow down things, the action potentials will travel slower. And so in a lot of invertebrate papers, which is in the world that I'm in, these are crickets and grasshoppers. When you're doing these experiments, you have to be sure that you're doing the experiments at the temperature that the animal would be in the outside world, right? So when we look at things at grasshopper, I think I have some videos, maybe it's coming up, of some grasshopper vision stuff. You actually see that does play a huge difference. And you can actually do these experiments at home. We have a worm. I think I actually have some pictures coming up here, but I'll get to that in a second. So this is our spiker box. These are real pictures from real students that have seen it for the very first time, and you can see these are not like stage photos. This is like their minds are blown when they understand. There is like they get that reality that what's happening is there is happening inside of their brains. They're just like, whoa, you see this face melting moment, right? It's portable. This is like back when we were developing it, we took it onto a Delta Airlines plane, and we were showing that you could bring spikes into an airplane, and so this is the kind stewardess that gave us the ice from our fair little tray. We did an experiment, and we tried to measure. We did the experiment on the ground, then did it back into the airplane to see if there was a difference in firing rate between the pressure of the airplane. There was no data on that. It was inconclusive, but they were kind enough to do that. We also put, it was a long distance flight. We were flying to California. We put a sign up on the bathroom and said, come into seats 33A and B and come get learn some neuroscience. And there was a jump seat there, and people would come up, and these are just 2 passengers that were just given neuroscience lectures. It was kind of fun. So that's what we're trying to do, is try to encourage people to sort of bring this out to the public to get people interested in it. And I said before, we keep track of how many people have done it, so I'll go back tonight and add you guys. We've done about 40,000 people so far, which is kind of cool. And we develop experiments. So one of the experiments that you brought up is, so this is one about comparing speeds of 2 nerve fiber sizes. And we just added a new one a few months ago about comparing the speeds at different temperatures. So you can actually cool off a neuron and actually see that it actually changes the action potential speed. I'm going to skip this one. I won't skip this one. And then someone told me there was a mouse here. It's probably here. I want to show you this one. This is cool. Let's see if it works. Oh, it does. And even its volume, this is cool. All right, so this is a grasshopper now. And grasshoppers have the same neurons. And now I'm using our little 3D printed microscope. And I put a wire inside of his neck. And you notice that those are the same spikes that we saw earlier. But they're much, much bigger than what we saw earlier. And they're very distinct. But they seem to be doing that because of I'm touching it. I'm far away from it, moving slowly. So it seems to be vision, right? So why would this grasshopper care so much about the vision, about something moving? And so here is a real-life experiment. So now I'm going to pretend to throw a ball at this little grasshopper I've taped down. And what happens at just the moment before the ball would have hit the grasshopper? It's a different subject now. We slowed down the ball. So watch now when the ball hits. You're going to listen to it, and you're going to watch the spikes. So what do you think that neuron is doing? Does anyone have any guesses? Yeah, so it's called the descending motion detection, descending control of motion, DCMD. But it's a motion detection neuron, and it's responsible for creating the jump response. It takes so long for a grasshopper to jump its huge legs that it needs to start to prep the muscle to jump before it actually feels it coming in, right? So because if something coming in fast, it needs to 100 milliseconds, which is a long time in biological speaking, to jump away. So what it does, that neuron is sending it back to the jump muscles to get it ready to go, so that as soon as anything happens, it can jump away, which is cool. And it actually, this about 80% of the time causes it to jump. If you just kind of throw like a fake object at it, you know, it doesn't feel anything, but it sees it enough that it causes the jump. So it's cool. So this is an example of an invertebrate doing something, you know. So we have these same circuits in our body. They're doing stuff when you, if you're saying that someone pushes you and you fall like this, you know, it's not your brain sort of thinking like, oh, I should probably put my leg out. You know, all these things are kind of built in as little networks in our body that allow us to sort of react. All right. So this is just some of the data from that. I'm not going to get into it. But the point is that if you look at when the spikes fire, they fire just at the moment before the object would have hit the grasshopper. And this is a cool paper. This is I showed to my colleagues. This is in the journal Science, the number one science journal in the world. This is our data recorded I was in a lab somewhere, but you can see the data is exactly the same. So you don't need to have a lab. You just have a little bit of creativity and some tools, and you'll be able to do the exact same experiments people are publishing in the top journals in the world. So this is our evidence that you can actually do this type of stuff. The other thing I want to say is that we actually create boards. This is the circuit boards that we produce. We actually give you all the schematics for it, and we tell you exactly what each circuit does. We not only do that, we tell you why we put that thing there. So we will tell you that in ours, we chose these particular values because of this equation right here. And if you wanted to do something differently, you'd read that equation and change your values as you needed. I'm going to kind of skip over this, but this gets to your point. This is an earthworm, and I will just say a few things about this, and that is that an earthworm has a giant axon that runs all the way down the middle of the earthworm. So this is like taking a slice right through it. And so you see this part right here. It's this little pill right here. And if you zoom in there, these are these fibers. There's three axons that run all the way through it. One is bigger than the other two, all right? And so what we can do is we can record from two different, if we stretch out a worm and we put pins in two different locations. Just like when they're surveying roads, they want to know how fast people are driving, they put those two strips across, and they watch for the tires to go by the things. So if you know the distance between the two strips, and you know the timing at which the tires cross them, then you know the speed of the car, right? It's the same thing with these worms. If you stick two pins in a worm, and you watch the electrical spike as it passes by the first pin and then the second pin, then we know how fast the axon was sending the spike, right? So we can do that. And so it turns out that this is not temperature. This is actually looking at one end of the worm versus the other end of the worm. One end of the worm uses the little thin fibers. The other end of the worm uses this thick fiber. As you can see, the thin fibers are much, much slower. This is, takes longer time for that spike to travel versus the fast one. So it's kind of cool. So this is again, this is important for one side of the animal to sort of respond quickly, so therefore evolved throughout nature, sort of make that axon thicker, and that's why it actually is able to send the stuff a little bit thicker. Humans do something differently, but I'm not going to get into that. We've come up with a completely new way. I'll just tell you quickly. We insulate our axons with fat cells. We have these fat cells that allow the electricity to travel faster, just like you would insulate wires in the room here. I'm not going to go. This is our 3D printed microscope. So this is taken with our microscope, but these are those Golgi stains here, so you can actually see the neurons. This is me just picking my, with a toothpick inside my cheek cell, so that's my DNA right there. It's kind of cool. I was doing this for a teacher's conference. I was showing them because the people were interested in that. This is cool. I plucked my blood and I stuck it onto a slide. These are you can see white blood cells every once in a while. Most of my red blood cells. You see a big one. There are white blood cells. Anyway, I was just showing teachers that you can do other stuff with our experiments as well. All right, so let's talk about the second part, which is manipulating the brain. So we're going to go back to the brain here. We do a lot of stuff with brain, like cyborg stuff. And people get so scared about that, like, oh, my God, are you going to have, like, remote-controlled people? And so our joke was that, yeah, we call it society. It's actually a really high-level joke, but it's like society is really a brain control system, right? So there's, like, a government there. There's churches and institutions. Your mom and dad, they're all kind of controlling your behavior because you behave a certain way, and that's through a remote-control way because your brain circuits have evolved in a way to sort of allow you to do something. But if you put a wire in there and do that, then people get scared. So anyways, but I can, and for fair reasons, I can see why. But that's not coming anytime soon. But we do a number of things that sort of push into that realm, kind of push the envelope. It got people thinking about it, and so it's caused a lot of controversy. And I actually kind of like that. So we should be talking about that stuff. All right. So this is. Does anyone know this is on the left? Does the thing on the right jog any memories? Does anyone know who this is? So Luigi Galvani. He was a Italian scientist, and he was interested in frog legs. And he was laughed at, according to his memoir. He was called the king of the dancing frog legs. And people didn't understand it, but he said, one day they will. And sure enough, he was way 100 years ahead of his time, right? But he would do these cool experiments. He would hook up frog legs to a lightning rod, and wait for electricity to come by and lightning to hit this one, right? And then he would, as a good scientist, he would capture the electricity into this jar here, and then he can come back and measure the electricity to show that it was real, and then he would observe what happened to the frog legs. Does anyone have any idea what happened when the frog legs got hit by electricity? Yeah, they moved, right? Because of what we were talking about before. These are nerves with ions that are in there. When electricity hits an ion, it causes the ion to move, and it causes the spikes to occur. So we can do those experiments right now. This may or may not work. But did anyone bring with them a signal generator? Maybe like a stimulus isolator of any sort? Like an SRS? You can? How? Like that? Oh, yeah, okay, so bring your phone down. So that's what we're getting at. So if you can invigorate something on your phone... So your phone, let me see if I can find it here. And actually, we can even do something better. But we'll use that in just a moment. All right, so like, bring out your phone. So what we have here is an extension. This is like our biggest, we always joke that internally, this is our biggest contribution to science, this stupid little invention. It's like, it's a headphone jack on one end, right? And on the other end, we cut off the earbuds that normally go into your ear. And we put some hooks on there, and then what happens when you normally play music on your iPod? Does anyone know what happens when you play into your earbuds? How is that working? I didn't ask that question either. I was actually blown away when I heard. So there's a tiny magnet inside your earbud, all right? So when the current comes out of your phone, it runs across that magnet, causes it to sort of pull back a little bit. You glue a cone onto that magnet, so that magnet vibrates, the cone vibrates, and the cone vibrates creates sound. That's how your earbuds work. So I didn't know that, but now I do. And so, but this is something that plugs into your phone, and now instead of the current making a magnet move, we're going to stick the current directly into this cockroach leg, and we're going to see what happens when we hook this up to the phone. Actually, do you have music on your phone? Music?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll find out.
Let's see. How many things could you put in here?
Yes. And so what I'm going to do, so we know this cockroach leg is alive because I can listen to the neuron. I'll listen one more time, make sure it's alive. All right, so we're all neuroscientists now. We now understand that this is a living cockroach leg. So what we're going to do is we're going to hook up the living cockroach leg to these jumper wires. And we're going to stick it into a phone. And you guys might want to gather around for this one because I don't have like a big display thing. But if it works, then what we should see is what Luigi Galvani saw in mid-1780 or something like that. Okay, so go ahead and plug this in. All right, so there's music coming through there, but I don't see anything moving. Do you guys see anything yet? All right, so what could that mean? It could mean that the a couple things. Maybe this cockroach leg doesn't move.
And
that,
on pause.
Is it on pause, you think?
I don't know.
No, it was running. Okay. Or...
It only likes country music?
It only likes certain types of music. Does anyone have any hip-hop? All right, because there's a reason for it. All right, so let me see if I can find something. And we'll see. This maybe is a dead leg. We were talking about it earlier. This experiment doesn't work every time, but it's... He can stay in there for at least 8 hours. I mean, probably even longer. I mean, their metabolism rate drops, so they actually...
No, it
All right, so I'm going to play some hip-hop music really quick. Whoopsie. Beastie Boys, that's my... Yeah, let's do... Is that Beatles? All right, I'll do this one.
Beatles song, I think. Name that tune in 4 minutes,
yeah.
Huh?
Oh, man, it's not going to work. All right, well, we could either try to reseat the pins.
Dried up.
It could be dried up. But, oh, there it goes. Oh, hey, there it is. All right, so nothing up my sleeves. Let's see if I could get this.
Oh, dancing.
So it was just the location of the pin. So I'll turn this thing on again so we can hear the music. Yeah, okay. So, hey, it works. All right. This doesn't always work. All right. So I was just telling earlier that some people tell me not to do this experiment. It doesn't work every time. But there seems to be shorting.
Halloween next.
Yeah. All right. So you guys have a seat again. So there's a question. Everyone saw that working? All right. So the question is why? Why is that working? All right. So if we go back to our example earlier of these ions, right? These sodium potassiums. But there's the moving of a sodium ion creates a current, right? But the same thing happens the other way. If I push current into the cell, it's going to cause ions to move. And so when I cause ions to move, it allows enough sodium to rush through. It's going to trigger an action potential, and that's going to cause the leg to twitch, right? So this is what happens. This is going on the output of the brain now. And so this is like going from the inside of the brain, you sort of sense things. Going from the brain back out to your muscles, you move things. And so what we were just stimulating right there were the neurons that were controlling the muscles to twitch, right? The same thing that Galvani saw in the 1780s. As a side note, I will say that the Mary Shelley's Frankenstein came out roughly around the same time as this experiment because people started to have this discussion like, oh my God, could this be real? Could we actually start to create, you know, dead things coming back to life? It was a big scare. And so that book was kind of tapped into that fear. But it turns out that's not the case, that this leg, as you can see, it was a bit finicky. I had to reseat the pins, and there's not a lot of energy. There's a lot of ATP that's required to cause that muscle to move. It's that ATP, that energy kind of runs out pretty quickly. But I won't go into the details here, but I will show you. This is a fun video. I got to show it to everybody. We do all types of invertebrates. This is an ocean critter. This is a squid. And so what we've done here is I've taken my iPod and I split it into two. And I put one of it into a speaker so we can hear it and the other one into the fin nerve of a squid. And squids are cephalopods, are the only animals that communicate through color. And so they have about, like, I think, I don't know, maybe like two dozen different patterns that they show to sort of communicate either fear or that they're mating and this type of stuff through the surface of their skin. So if we can tap into the skin, into the nerves, we can do some interesting things. And so this is the equivalent of the dancing cockroach leg inside of a squid.
Were you trying to get crazy
with this? Okay, so this is, again, this is living skin tissue. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah, so now I'm just looking at it through a microscope, and we're just playing hip-hop music. And the same thing happens when that bass frequency hits the nerve, it causes those action potentials, which then causes the squid skin to become its color. Isn't that kind of beautiful? So this actually was a viral video a couple years ago, and we got like a million hits in a day. We got to be on like Science Friday and stuff like that. People were talking about the squid. It was cool. So it was an exciting period. Keeping it fresh, you know. All right, but that's kind of fun. I want to share this video with you. This is, does everyone know what cochlear implants are? So this is kind of the... it's sad to say it's cutting edge neuroscience. Technology is about 25 years old now. But here's a video I like to show of a girl who has it turned on for the very first time.
It's like so close.
So it's gonna. She's deaf, you cannot hear, and so this allows you to hear again by sort of causing the same way that the squid cells turned on by electricity inside the nerve, which causes the nerves to fire. So we're going to watch her as we turn it on for the first time.
There
I say
go.
We, it's not me. But
so now they, technically your device is on. Can you tell? Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Here, you can put it down for a second.
So this is a pretty amazing technology. So this is the the intersection between electricity and neurons that we're talking about now. So this is, you saw it in the cockroach blood, you saw it in the squid. This is what it looks like in a human. And what's happening in this video is the fact that she's perceiving something from the outside world through an electrical impulse inside of her brain. So what can we do to sort of bring this into the classroom to let kids do this as well? And so this is our next invention, which we call the Roboroach, the cyborg cochroach, which does the exact same thing a cochlear implant does, but inside of a cochroach. All right, so how does it work? So if you look at a cochroach, you look at its antennas here. The antennas are filled with hairs, and we saw earlier in our experiment what happens when the hairs get touched. They fire action potentials. The action potentials are going to go travel all the way back to the brain, right? And that lets the cockroach know that it's being touched on either side. All right, so then you look at the behavior of the cockroach, and you say, all right, if you touch the cockroach on the left side, or you blow on its antenna on the left side, what does the cockroach tend to do? It moves away, all right? So we're going to take the next leap, and we're going to say, what would happen that instead of making that neuron fire because we touched it, that we put a small wire inside the antenna and we allow electricity to pass through and send electrical impulse into that neuron, tells that neuron to tell the brain that it touched something. So could we actually make something that is a remote-controlled animal, a cyborg insect? So the answer is we've done this, and that's what we call the Roboroach. What our Roboroach looks like. So we bring in his antennas, and we tap a wire inside of him into a connector here. And you can see this is one of our colleagues showing it off. And here it is, the three holes in the back. And so this is permanently on the animal. And so when we're done, we just sort of release the antennas from there. But this will stay with him for the rest of his life, unless it falls off. And then what we do is we put a backpack on the cockroach, and we pair that backpack with a cell phone. All right, so this is a Bluetooth signal coming from here. And this is all developed here in Ann Arbor. So this is in the basement of All Hands Active, just right around the corner is where we were doing all these experiments. So now we're going to connect to our cockroach. And so it's got a circuit board on the back, and the Bluetooth makes a connection. And so now I'm pretending to touch its antenna, but I'm actually not touching his antenna. I'm actually touching the cell phone, which tells the cockroach that I'm touching his antenna. And you can see him turning around. So here's kind of some fun. You can take your cockroach out for a walk. So I'm telling him to go right, go left. Isn't that cool? So this is the exact same way that the cochlear implant works in a human. This works in a cockroach. The brain perceives that electrical impulse as a real impulse that's natural. So like she could hear voices again because the electrical impulses were in there. This cockroach is feeling things on its left and right side because we're sending electrical impulses. Anyway, so this is one of the kits that we make for K-12 to get people interested in neuroscience. And this is kind of in the cutting edge. What's cool about this one, it allows people to really explore that space and understand like what parameters you have to do to get cochlear implants to work, all right? Every summer we do an internship, and we do about 7 interns every summer. And so someone wanted to look at if they could make a robo-scorpion. And so here's so you can see we got the stimulation side on. Every time the stim light comes on, you can see that the cockroach starts to move its tail, right? And so we found out that if, depending on the species of it, you could actually create kind of cyborg scorpions that will either move their talons or they move their tails. It's kind of cool. So and we're starting to map that out. We're starting to publish that into a paper. And so we do, every summer we do 5 to 7 interns down in the basement of All Hands Active. And we're going to hopefully come here in the summer and actually start doing some of these talks here. This is really cutting edge. This is, I'll say this about it. We are an exciting period in neuroscience, in the history of neuroscience. We are learning more every month that we have in the previous like decades before that because of this new technology called optogenetics. It's a way to control neurons, and I'll use this analogy here. Instead of using lesioning, which I was told you about scooping out that ice cream brain and cutting out a part of the brain, seeing what happens, which is how we've done neuroscience up until 2006. But after 2006, we now have a way that we can go into the circuit and just turn off one neuron or turn it on. And so it's called optogenetics. We use light and genetics to do this. And we're happy to announce at Backyard Brains that we are now able to do this in the classroom. So this is a kit that we've made that allows you to actually manipulate a Drosophila, a fruit fly, using light and depending on how you breed that fruit fly, we could actually control the neurons inside of it and do these beautiful behaviors. And you can have them see, you know, sexual reproduction. You can look at like how do they eat. So this is a particular one. He sticks his tongue out. I'll show you a video really quick. Every time we turn the light on, you're going to see these are cockroaches. These are fruit flies. And every time we turn the light on, they think they're tasting something sweet. And so they're going to stick their tongues out, right? This is kind of cool. So we're actually looking at the behavior of what happens when a neuron fires that makes the fruit flies think they're landing on something sweet. So I won't say it, but this is huge. This is like the biggest thing that's happened in neuroscience. This is going to create actual probably like really tangible treatments for people in the next 10, 15 years. All right, so let's get into the human stuff. Everyone wants to see. All right, so again, the brain. We talked about the brain as the sensory input. We looked at the cockroach being touched. We looked at the sensory input of the cockroach and the roboroach being stimulated. We looked at cochlear implants. Those are all sensory information coming to the brain. But the brain has another function, right? It controls the body. It moves it around. And so that's what we're going to look at right now, and we're going to end it on this. So I'm going to show you one more invention here. I need one more volunteer to step forward. Don't be shy. All right, come on down. Perfect. All right, so now what we're going to do is I'm going to hook up your brain. And this took us forever. When I was a neuroscientist at the University of Michigan, it always bothered me when I was recording from spikes because the rats that I was recording from rats, they would move around. And every time they would move, their muscles would twitch. And every time the muscles would twitch, your ants would get flooded with this noise, like this gross interference, what I refer to it. But it turns out that actually is a neural signal. That's your motor cortex. So in your brain, if you were to move your right arm like this, it's your brain on your left side sending a command down to your spinal cord. You can see here. It crosses over for reasons we don't quite understand evolutionarily, and it allows that muscle to move. And so I can put some electrodes, if you raise your arm, on your muscles, and we're going to use your muscles as an amplifier to sort of make these really small signals that are inside your brain big enough that we can actually record it through the surface of the skin. In the same way that we talked about neurons, we could talk about muscles, because we're actually going to now record from those muscles that are receiving one-to-one mappings of information inside the brain, okay? So this is what's called the motor output. So I'm going to hook you up, and it's going to sound slightly different. This signal is going to sound not like the spikes that you see from the cockroach. It's going to sound a little bit different because it's not the actual neuron action potential. These are motor action potentials. I'm going to hook you up here, and I'll turn it on. All right, so when you're ready, I want you to just go ahead and squeeze your hand. Beautiful. All right. It sounds almost the same, but it's going to sound a little bit deeper because these are motor experts which have, instead of being 1 millisecond long, they're about 3 milliseconds long. Yes, you can find out which. Yeah, so you can do that. All right. So now the question is, what can we do with this? All right. So this is one part of a. Let me see if I have some slides in this. This is new stuff. Yeah. So this is one. The holy grail of neuroscience is this. You take part of the brain, I record your brain, and I allow it to control part of the muscles. If you have a spinal cord injury, you can then sort of, if I could decode what the brain's doing, and I can send it to the muscles, and I can actually make someone walk around again after they've been paralyzed, right? So what we have is, this is an Arduino controller. Is everyone familiar with what Arduinos are or what they do? Do you want me to explain what that is? I'm just joking. He's part of the makerspace. So an Arduino is like a little tiny computer, and so we always use this analogy. Is if you want to make a simple program that does something, a cat puts its paw on a sensor, and then food comes out, right? You don't want to hook up your PC and stick it there. You can do that, but you don't want to do that. You want to just buy a little cheap little microcontroller that's going to sense the cat putting something on there and then spit out the food, right? So it's a little mini computer that you could program to do one specific thing, all right? So that's what a microcontroller does. And so what we've done, we've taken our speaker box, which you're listening to right now, and we stuck it onto a microcontroller, and that allows us to take this signal and begin to start looking at that brain-machine interface, okay? So I'll have you turn this off now. I'm going to plug this guy into here. So now we're going to do the you're going to move your arm again. Arm again. Sounds like Armageddon. You're going to move your arm again. All right, go ahead and squeeze it. So now what we're doing is we've taken that EMG signal that we were listening to, and we fed it into the input so that we said, all right, so now when we sense an EMG, go ahead and squeeze really hard there, perfect. We're going to turn on these LEDs. Like those, remember those things like in the circus where you hit that bar? So you see how strong you are. It's a strongman thing. Oh, all right, you got up to the top. All right. So that's cool, but you know, this is the AADL. This audience gets sophisticated very quickly. And they're not very impressed with turning the lights on. So let's see what else we can do to make this a little bit more appealing to the masses. All right. So what we're going to do now, we're going to create a brain-machine interface. Does that sound good? All right. So let's do that. So I'm going to plug in another battery to control this guy right here. I'm going to stick him into here. I can't remember which way it goes. Oh, there it is. So go squeeze your hand. Ah, relax it. Ah, it's cool. So this is a very simple DIY brain machine interface. So why I call it brain machine, because your brain is commanding your muscles to move, right? I command thee to move, and you move it, right? And your brain is now being picked up through the electrodes on her arm and being sent into a microcontroller, which we're then using it to decode the signal right here. So we actually have 1D control of a hand, right? So you have a gripper. It's called a gripper motion. All right. So, all right. Is that cool? All right, let's hear it for the gripper. What was your name? I'm sorry.
Uma.
Yeah. I was here for Uma. She's the star. Okay. So, do you guys want more? All right. So, all right. What else you got? All right. I need one more volunteer. Anyone else? You want to do it again? All right. So, all right. All right. You can't blame me. She knew what she's getting into. All right. So one of the things that we like to do is sort of show that the living on the bleeding edge. Oh, they're gonna miss this one. This is everyone who's in this room is gonna remember this night for the rest of their lives. For you have seen something that you never thought was possible before. All right, so we have here a brain-machine interface we saw before. Now we're going to do a brain-to-brain interface, okay? So, Uma, is that what it was?
Yeah.
When you move your arm like this, like, your brain is sending a command to your muscles here, all right? I'm going to have you stand over here. What was your name again?
Heidi.
So when Heidi moves her arm, her brain is also sending a command to her muscles here, okay? So when they both move at the same time, so they're both brains are doing the exact same thing. So if we were to be able to record from your EMG as well as yours, you would see roughly the same signal, okay? So the question is, what would happen if we recorded from your brain into this machine here, and instead of just making a muscle move, or excuse me, making a machine move like this, we instead sent a signal into your nerve which caused your muscles to move? And it will be commanded not through your brain, but through the brain of Uma as she moves her hand over here. And so this is what we call the human-to-human interface, and it allows us to take the free will of another person. And so and we're going to do that by attacking a nerve right here. It's called the ulnar nerve. This is the nerve that you hit when you hit your funny bone onto something, and that hurts because you're causing that nerve to fire in both directions, and it feels weird and that's why they call it the funny bone. So I'm going to stick that thing onto your nerve right here. I'm going to try to find it. All right.
So you're getting the least desirable.
Yeah. Cool. We'll try that. It may or may not work. All right, so the, okay. So I'm going to hook you up to here, and then I'm going to hook you together. So this is what's called a TENS device. It's a microstimulator that just sends small bits of current, just like we'd said about the iPhone. We hooked it in there. We were causing that leg to move. We're doing the same thing, but now it's going to hit your nerve here. And now I'm going to wire you two together, so that when you move your arm, you're going to trigger this thing, and it's going to trigger that one, all right? Does everyone understand what's going on so far? One brain controlling two bodies, all right? That's the summary of it. It's going to feel weird for a second. It always sort of feels weird when you lose your free will for the very first time. I did this last week at a conference in California, and I was like, have you ever had your free will lost before? And the guy says, I've been married for 28 years. That was pretty funny. I never heard that response. All right, so All right, so let's try it again. So I'm gonna turn it on slowly. So, whoops. Okay, so go ahead, and when you're ready, I want you to squeeze your hand.
Oh my God! All right, so I don't ever like this kind of power.
All right, so you don't like this power? No. Is it too much for you to handle right now? All right, so let's do it. So I want you to look the other way. So there's nothing up our sleeves. All right, go ahead. When you want to move your hand, go ahead and move it. All right, do it still. Sorry, maybe turn a little bit higher. Go ahead, do it again. So what's happening was we're recording her muscle. We're sticking it into another nerve here so that one arm is controlling two. All right. So now the question is, how far can we take this? I mean, could I put my free will onto you, move your arm, and then cause her arm to move? What do you guys think?
Probably.
All right, so relax your arm. So why not?
I'm not using my brain.
Yeah, your brain. You have to. It has to be your brain. So you do it again. All right. All right. So that's it for the demonstration portion. So give a round of applause for our brave souls over here, Heidi and Uma. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. And I'm going to end it there. I'm just going to just give you an idea of what we're doing. So you guys can have. You guys leave those on.
All right. Souvenirs?
Yeah, those are souvenirs. Those are industrial grade. I think I read the package once. I think that you can keep them on for like 4 days, and you can shower in them or something. But I just want to give you an idea of what we're trying to do. So we are we stopped our the academic career, and so I was at a university, and I no longer at a university. So this is my university right here, and Tim's. And one of the things we like to do is sort of interact with the public and sort of do these demonstrations. We saw the experiments we put online. We have about 30 projects online, and we have run our own labs here. And so instead of bringing on graduate students, we bring in high school students or undergraduate students, and we put them into individual tasks, and we have them write scientific peer-reviewed papers. So we're doing exactly what you do in a graduate school, except for instead of getting money through tuition, we get money through the sales of these products here. And so if you have friends that are in the education system, I used to end it with kind of showing where we're going. I'm not sure if I have anything else. Sure. Ah, so there's a one-way device, and so we could do is we could hook two of them up. So it's like a neuron, right? You have one input. You are the dendrite, and she was the axon. So you were like sending the information to her. So if you wanted it the other way, we could hook up one device to her, and she can control back. And so.
I mean, like, what if she tries to move her arm while?
Oh, we can do those experiments in a bit. We can try this. So you can try to resist it, and even if she wants to resist it. I could turn it up, and there's just no way she can resist it. All right. So you can do those. You can do those games. It's actually a lot of fun stuff you can do with the TENS device, and so like, those like, kind of cycle. Let me see what I have at the end here. I didn't bring any of those slides in, but I like to end it by talking about where we're going next, because that's what everyone wants to know. So like we've been. Somewhat successful. We're in our sixth year of the company. We've gotten grants from the NIH to help us support us to this point. Next year, our grant runs out, and so we're hoping that we're going to be able to sell our gear to sort of continue this quest a little bit more. We've been somewhat successful. We've been given a number of kind of high-profile talks that have gotten people interested, but it's through word of mouth, people like you. So if you have friends that are in the education business and you want to say, hey, you know, some of your science teachers may be interested. There's this crazy guy I met at the Ann Arbor Public Library. He was doing some weird stuff. Maybe check it out. That's how we kind of grow our company. So if you can, please do me that favor, sort of like let people know about that. I'd appreciate it. But anyway, thank you guys for your time. More questions? Fifth grade on up is where we do it. And so we tend to focus on that. We don't tend to go out. We do these public engagements once in a while. We don't tend to go out to schools. All of our experiments are online. And we give you all the tools and resources, the teacher's guides, the videos, to help create. Because if we go out to the schools and try to teach people, we'll increase the world by 40,000 people, right? But if we can train teachers to do it, then we're going to increase it by millions of people is what we want, what we're going for. So, yeah, we work for fifth grade and up, and then every year, if you guys ever come by in the summertime in All Hands Active, which is in the basement over underneath the Michigan Theater, stop on down, come on down, then you'll see some experiments. This summer we worked with grasshoppers, we worked with electric fish, which I didn't show, some a continuation of fruit flies. We were doing circadian rhythm. How does the brain follow the track the stars or the basically the star, the sun? We have neurons in our brain that track that. We were actually monitoring that in cockroaches, and we were doing experiments with recording from EKGs, so from our hearts, and from moths. We were looking at the sexual, so when a moth can detect another moth from 2 kilometers away, which is true, through 1 part in a billion is what it can detect. So we were looking at the antennas of moths and introducing them with pheromones from a female, and you could see that a male moth would go crazy, whereas a female moth wouldn't even detect it. So it's kind of a cool experiment. Anyway, these are the type of things that we're trying to do, and we're trying to help push this from graduate level science into the high schools, into the grade schools, to get people interested in thinking about the brain. Thank you so much for all of your time tonight. I tried to get done before 8:30, and I did it. All right. Thank you.